Even without the COVID-19 pandemic, try to imagine that, there is plenty of basis for referring to this time as a dark time in history. We continue to hurt and threaten each other in myriad ways, and fear is a great motivator for a great number of actions. Anytime someone talks about a light at the end of the tunnel, some wise guy says maybe it's a train. Our guest this hour thinks deeply about the way ahead, person by person, step by step. Anne Lamott is the author of Dusk, Night, Dawn, on revival and courage. Anne Lamott has probably received more short biographical introductions, like this one, than most people alive. Progressive, activist, Christian, author, and more. By my count, 11 nonfiction books, 7 works of fiction. She was here for Imperfect Birds 10 years and one day ago. Anne Lamott, welcome back. Anne Lamott, are you there? Okay. We seem to have lost Anne Lamott. She was having some problems with her power, so we're going to give her a try once again and see if we can pick her up at her home north of San Francisco. But it's a fairly amazing book, Dusk, Night, Dawn, on Revival and Courage. Gives us a look at not just things going on in Anne Lamott's own life, but in the life of humanity in general, and a way for us to see a way down the road ahead of us where things aren't quite as dark and gloomy as they have been from time to time of late, not just through the pandemic, but also because of this period in political history and the fact that we can't seem to get along terribly well. Lots of challenges that we present to each other as human beings, and for that matter, present to the planet at the same time. A major cause of concern for a lot of people is where we stand in relation to the environment around us, that things just aren't going terribly well as we continue to pump greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and get above what was considered the more or less safe level of carbon, 350 parts per billion. Well, we're well over that now and well over 400. So these are the kinds of things that come up when we consider the fate of humanity at the moment. And these are the things that Anne Lamott talks about, writes about in Dusk, Night, Dawn, on Revival and Courage, her latest book. Anne Lamott, I was looking at the notes that actually I pulled up from our last interview, which was, again, one year and or 10 years and one day ago, about the fact that Anne Lamott has been an inspiration to a lot of people, covering subjects such as alcoholism, being a single mother, being depressed, being Christian. She takes a pro-choice stance, which at times has invited controversy, especially with other Christians. So a lot of different things to take up when you take up the story of Anne Lamott, which we certainly hope to do once she gets her power restored in the Bay Area. And off we go. We hope to talk about Dusk, Night, Dawn, on Revival and Courage. Tell you what, while we try, let's cue up today's edition of Marketplace Tech and just play that right now. Oh, no, looks like we got her. Do we have her? We have Anne Lamott? Okay. We're gonna push the right buttons and get Anne Lamott on the air. And here we go. Anne Lamott, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you. We just are having a power outage and then a power onage and then a power outage and then a... But we're good right now. I can hear you loud and clear to Oregon.
Excellent, excellent. I was pointing out it's been 10 years and one day since the last time you were here, and I was wondering, can we book you for the first Monday in April 2031?
Yes, I'm good. I'm free.
Okay. Excellent, okay. So you describe the darkness of our time, but always with a sense of humor. You know, you write, "I await the rain of frogs." I guess we talk about that in our household, too.
Yeah, I do. It was a terrible, terrible dark night of the soul and the nation when I started writing Dusk, Night, Dawn. I mean, I don't remember a darker night in American history. And, and then the UN climate change reports had just come out, and hope was really lost, and people were really terrified. And that didn't even include what might be going on at their own dining room table. Didn't include, you know, scary teenagers. It didn't include, you know, life, real life, and still couldn't have been bleaker. So I decided to write a book about that.
I pointed out that a lot of personal stuff intertwined here. You got married for the first time in 2019. Congratulations.
Thank you. I got married 3 days after I got Medicare, not knowing that my second year of marriage would take place in a quarantine.
Oh, wow. That's been an amazing journey then, huh?
Uh-huh.
So I want to just jump ahead to that, because I just what it was that you said when Neil Allen first asked you to marry him.
Oh, well, we were watching the U.S. Open. I believe I was watching. We've been living together for a couple of years, so it wasn't really on my mind. And he said, Can I ask you something? And I thought we needed some patio pebbles that we were going to get at Home Depot before we started boycotting Home Depot because they won't take a stand against the Georgia voter suppression bill. And so I said, oh, yeah, sure. And he said, will you marry me? In my mouth, I said, wait, what? And he said, will you marry me? But our cat, who we loved, had just disappeared about a month earlier. And I said, can we get a cat? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, I'll marry you.
So what if Neil had said no to the cat?
Then we would have been in trouble because I've always said, and I say again in Dusk Night Dawn, that the love of our cats and dogs is probably the closest we're going to come to knowing the divine love of God on this side of eternity.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing way to think about it. So, which gives us an inkling of the way up for humanity. I mean, decency and kindness. And you're right that the hardest work we do is self-love and forgiveness. And I found myself wondering if we've gotten to a place in this world where we regard too many things as not forgivable.
We do. There's a story in the book about, it takes place in my Sunday school class, which at my failing church. I was telling him about a friend whose daughter had hit and run, killed somebody, a pedestrian, on New Year's Eve, and asked my kids, who were three or four different ages, I said, could you forgive her? And they said, no, not because she made a horrible mistake, but because she ran, because she was so cowardly. And I said, tick tock, just wait. You know, you will do cowardly are us. You know, we screw up right and left, and you will. I have done things that are so pathetic, and so then that led to a discussion of the soul, and that maybe we focus on the appearance and the behavior of ourselves and others, because that's what we were raised to do. How do we look? What's everybody else making of us? But if you think about the soul, you think about something that can't be damaged, and that is just as pure and sweet as the new baby in church, you know, that feels sometimes like our inner Donald Trump is, blowharding or dominating or whatever. But below that, it's like my kids see a Russian nesting doll. Huh. And on the outside is the blowhard and the person of judgment, which is me.
Okay, so darn those brakes. They fire on exactly the same time. So we have to go to them.
That's okay. I just was saying that my kids, their immediate response is certain things are not forgivable. Cowardice is not forgivable. But then if you go a little deeper out, beyond the behavior or inside through the Russian nesting dolls of appearance, persona, blah, 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 to the inside self. I asked my kids, what do you think the soul is? And the little girl said she thought it was a tiny Pikachu creature in the very heart of us, which I love, my favorite definition. And then a 15-year-old boy said he thought it was like a sparkly snow globe inside of us. But the point was, it was inside of us. And if they went inside, then they could imagine forgiving somebody for cowardice, or for terrible behavior. And so if we could forgive, that, maybe, with a little nautilus of the soul, we can start to forgive ourselves. And when we forgive ourselves, oh my God, buckle up, all things are possible.
Can a soul change in a lifetime? Can the essence of a human being be altered, do you think?
I think the soul is the soul, is my understanding, which is to say I'm a dropout. But my understanding is that you just have a soul that's a little piece of, like a tiny little snow globe of the great love energy that, as a believer, I feel surrounds us and indwells us. So I think the soul is just... However, a lot of Dusk Night Dawn is about the soul getting really clouded up, like a dirty windshield. There's a chapter called Soul Windex, because in the last few years, and even in our family, just as much in our families, the crisis and the sense of defeat and the sense of darkness and hope. In fact, let me just say, I wrote this book because the last book was on hope. It was called Almost Everything, Thoughts on Hope. And so I was doing a book tour, which we used to do in person all around the country. And everywhere I went to talk and read from this book on hope, people just felt flattened. You know, they felt like it was all, my mother was from Liverpool, so it's like, it's all over for England this time, for sure. And I'd say it really isn't. You know, certain things have worked before and will again. And so I wrote a book about what always works. Love always works. Candles always light. Your two or three very best friends are really the reason any of us have a great faith in it, that life supports us and that goodness is the ultimate reality. So I just started writing a whole book on, I know what it's like to be in the dark night of the soul. I've 35 years ago got sober, and 9.5 years ago, my son, who's 31 now, Sam, got sober. So the few years before that were the ultimate dark night where I thought I might lose my child. And so what worked? And what might just work again if we remember to change channels from the channel of doom and of, you know, the Hope book was originally called Doomed, Thoughts on Hope, but my publisher wouldn't go for it for obvious marketing reasons.
So I think I laughed out loud at least three times before page 20 of Dusk, Night, Dawn. And I wonder if you could share the long ago story of being newly sober and calling the 24-hour hotline for alcoholics.
I love that story. Well, I'd been sober not that long, I was doing a huge book event in Miami, and I was on a top floor, and I was just in despair. I was exhausted by trying to stay sober. My hotel refrigerator was filled with bottles of booze. I couldn't sleep, and I thought about jumping. It just crossed my mind. And I did something that I think was the movement of grace in my life, grace as spiritual WD-40. I got spritzed, and I picked up the 200-pound phone, and I called the hotline for alcoholics and addicts. And there was someone there, and he said, he was very young, like 20s or something. He said, oh, I'll just send a woman over to help you. I said, it's like midnight. And a much older woman from Texas with very high hair, you know, as Ann Richards said, the higher the hair, the closer to God, came over in what I learned was a pink Cadillac, and she came up to the 18th floor or wherever I was, and she came in, and we just shared our experience, strength, and hope. We talked about our problems. We talked about our sense of defeat. We talked about how scary early recovery is. We laughed. I cried a little, and then she put water by my bed and turned the sheets down, and God blessed me and left. And I thought, this isn't a story where I think where I've shown the children that there's actually a story in the Hebrew Bible where Moses sees God's backside, which the children find hilariously funny. But I could tell them I've seen God's, you know, car, and it's a pink Cadillac with Texas license plates.
Anne LaMotta is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Dusk, Night, Dawn on Revival and Courage. So we get the story of God in the pink Cadillac in the middle of a tale of you, the newlywed, harshing on your husband, as a friend put it, and the friend not being surprised, which kind of connects those stories in my mind. We tend to think of our stuff as only ours. We're the only people suffering like this.
I know. Well, you know, one of the words we use for alcohol, the acronyms, is the alcoholism, is the I self me, I self me, I self me, I self me. And it's always for me the Annie Lamott show, you know, and I, without a lot of outside help, I operate from a place of the I self me, I self me. Who is annoying me, and who is to blame for my unhappiness? and how can I get them to behave better so that I will feel happier and less stressed? So, but there are ways, and a lot of Dusk, Night, Dawn is about this, that we can break that trance, you know, and that we can get out of ourselves where it might be just miserable in the pinball machine of our mind and get plugged into something that is sort of sweeter. Or, you know, there's this guy, I mentioned this in the book, in 1935, who helped Bill Wilson get AA off the ground, who was not himself an alcoholic, but he said to Bill, "Sometimes I think that heaven is just a new pair of glasses." And so I often have the bad glasses on of how annoying and disappointing people are, but really I'm the annoying and disappointing person. And if I put on the better pair of glasses where I can look around me at nature, there are daffodils outside my window with their hilarious yellow and red clown frills on, and they're huge noses, and there's green shoots now breaking through the grout and the concrete. And I put those good glasses on of paying attention and looking for beauty, looking for people who might need help. Then I get happy again. And so that I live by that. Sometimes I think that heaven is just a new pair of glasses.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, right.
It's funny you talk about the pinball machine of our mind. I've seen other discussions in AA and Al-Anon material about don't go into your mind alone. It's not a safe place.
No, it's a bad neighborhood, and you should not go in there alone. You should either go in there with God or with your little Pikachu creature, you know, or with a friend. And it's a bad neighborhood, and it's also, you know, it's like this chapter on soul Windex. It's like the world leaves us pretty smudged and schmutzy, and so there. But there are ways to clean off the glass through which we look. And then, just like the story you just mentioned, that was about being really annoyed with my husband because I didn't think he was performing at it.
Oops. Oh, well, I have that problem again with the phone. So it's Anne Lamott talking to us here on the Jefferson Exchange about her latest book, Dusk, Night, Dawn, on revival and courage. And it really is about looking out of a fairly dark period in human history to a way ahead. And it really is about taking a step at a time, a person at a time. We think we'll get her back, in which case you can join the conversation on the Exchange. The phone number is 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. You also can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. As you've heard, some changes over the years in Anne Lamott's life. She's been sober for 35 years, did she say? And so has been putting things together bit by bit. Is a Christian, is an progressive activist, has a lot going on, is always highly in demand, both for the reading of her books and for the talking about the reading of her books, and very generous with her radio time. I couldn't believe how many other interviews I was finding out there available with Anne Lamott on various radio shows. So I'm pretty confident we'll get her back if the power just zips back on up there in Marin County. 800-838-3760 for you to check into the interview by phone or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. It's interesting. It's almost like trying to get a hold of Anne Lamott by phone is kind of illustrative of the sorts of things she talks about in the book, where it's really just about appreciating what is going on outside. So she was talking about looking out the window and seeing daffodils with their great red noses and yellow frills and all of that, and their clown faces. But so it gives me a chance to look outside the window and see the clouds, and Anne Lamott is back.
I am back. This is what we call life on life's terms, where utility companies.
So, yeah, anyway, you give me a chance to look out the window and appreciate what's outside
yeah.
here. Just get into the clouds when you get back on the line here.
Yeah.
I've heard the phrase, the center cannot hold, which you use in the book, so much that the meaning dulls with time. And it's very interesting to see that William Butler Yeats wrote it in the last pandemic. What does the phrase mean to you?
Well, it's in the greatest of his poems that he wrote right after World War One, you know, the war to end all wars, and in deep, deep, deep darkness and despair. And he said, the center cannot hold anymore. Everything is too crazy. But I think in the basis of Dusk, Night, Dawn is that the center does hold. It always has before, eventually. I wrote a book of spiritual essays called Grace, and then Improve. Parentheses, eventually, you know, grace is spiritual, WD-40. It might not spritz us this afternoon right after lunch, but it will. Grace does bat last. And so the poem, to me, is just as beautiful as it ever was. And I can tell people the name of it in a minute. It's very profound, but Dusk Night Dawn is about, that it does hold, that you just have to put the good pair of glasses on and see.
The Second Coming is the name of the poem.
The Second Coming, thank you. Mm-hmm. We are really, the Wi-Fi now is not working at my house, so I couldn't look it up for you.
Oh, I got it.
You're my big boy helper. to me it means that it feels like it won't. It feels internally like it won't. It feels all around us. Like, for 4 years, because I am an old lefty, you know, it's like my husband and I turned on the MSNBC at 6:45 to see what the breaking news was, and it would be a new, absolute, devastating news story. But then at noon, there'd be a new one that had nothing to do with the earlier one. And then at 4, there'd be a new one, and then by the time Rachel Maddow was on at 6, there'd be a new one. And we did this for 4 years, and it didn't feel like the center was holding, except Mr. Rogers' mother said that incredible line when he was a little boy and there was tragedy or crisis all around him. She said, look to the helpers. And if I remember that line, and I reminded my readers or my Twitter followers about that line, you looked at the EMTs. Just during the quarantine, during the pandemic, we looked to the nurses, we looked to the doctors, we looked to the people delivering food to the elderly, and we saw that something was still working. Love was still working. Kindness was still working. When I was coming up, I was just born in the 60s, my mind just went blank. There was something that we, two phrases. One was the common good, and you always heard everyone talking about the common good, and you heard about sacrifice and sacrificial love, which we didn't hear a lot since about 2010. But to remember those words, what can you do today that will help the commonwealth? It help everybody, not just Anne Lamott, you know, in a cranky mood. What will lift me today? But you look like during the quarantine, the people that were hardest hit live in two areas. And I live in a very wealthy county, Marin, but over in Marin City, where my church of 36 years is, and in a area called the Canal District, which is where the service people work, that is where COVID hit hardest because they serve us and they are exposed. And so how can you serve today? Well, you can go by Safeway, buy a sack of canned good and powdered goods and Peeps that are now on sale for the little ones, and drive it over to the Canal District and donate it anonymously to the food pantry, you know, and just signal to someone to come over and get this bag of goods, and let people feed their children. During the Texas, the freeze, what was that, 2 months ago, or I can't remember.
February, yeah.
Yeah. 3 months ago, Texas froze, and that meant poor people and the elderly were dying. And so, but what we got to see, based on what Mr. Rogers' mother said, if we look to the helpers, we saw a global response. But people, you know, figure it out is a big slogan. And people worldwide did not try and figure out their political feelings about the Red Cross. You know, they just gave $25 or $1,000 or four, whatever they could. And people were helped. People were given warmth. People were given food for their children. You know, I call the pandemic COVID college, because what we discovered were deeper and deeper wells of compassion inside of us. We discovered that our hearts were breaking for the poor. Our hearts were breaking for the elderly and for the people in Africa and the people all over the world who were suffering. And even though I was enraged by that I was so limited. I mean, I've published Dusk Night Dawn in a pandemic. I haven't been to a single bookstore. I haven't gone to auditoriums and tried to convince people to buy my book. But you know what was happening in Appalachia and what was happening in the poorer parts of this country were trumped whatever I was going through. And what people discovered was how capable of love and sacrifice we were. We saw for a year the 3 and 4 mile lines of cars waiting to get a box of food for their kids and for their grandmas, and we responded. and we gave money, and we went to those pantries, and we doled out food, and we said to everybody who drove by, I am glad to see you. God bless you good. You take care. You come back when this runs out, you know? And that was a response I've never seen in my lifetime.
So we're good at rising to the occasion when people are suffering. I mean, are we less good then at handling good times?
I think we're good at good times. I think the mixed grill is the hardest part. But, you know, people 2 years ago when I was traveling around for the Hope book, the UN climate change report had just come out, and it was how hard it's going to be to turn this around. But I kept saying to people, we're good at hard. We're good at hard. We stopped fascism a couple times now. We stopped smallpox. We invented the antiretrovirals during the AIDS crisis. And so I think we're good at heart and we're good at happy. It's the mixed grill that's so confusing,
right?
At least for me.
So we were just talking about humans and the way we do rise to tragedy. We don't, you know, check somebody's political affiliation if they're bleeding to death or something. I mean, we take care of people. And I have noticed from alcoholic families, and I'll admit this is my birth family I'm talking about, that tragedies and drama are common. You know, do we as a society act the same sort of way, that we need to create this sense of drama to have something to respond to?
No, I think, you know, my life, like during the COVID college, my life was infinitely easier than almost all the world's. You know, I had a warm house and I had a nice husband, although I did not know my second year of marriage would be in quarantine. And I had everything I needed. But even in a family that is better off than most, life is hard and weird, and people don't do well. And there's mental illness and addiction, and there's extreme conflict in every family. There's scary teenagers, there's scary kids. My grandchild lives here, and he was on video school, and it was really painful. He's 11 going on 12, and he just longed for his fellowship, you know, his colleagues. And so it's like, I don't think we need to create any drama. I think we do. I know I do. I create drama and trauma sometimes because I'm good at it. But I'm good at handling it. You know, I got a owner's manual for handling drama and trauma when I was a kid trying to save my parents' marriage and both of my brothers. But I think sometimes without noticing it, we create a lot of stress. I create a lot of stress because I'm actually really good at handling it. I get a lot of worth, a sense of value by being the person that everybody comes to with their problems or wanting to tell their secrets to. And so I need to kind of bust the trance of getting a little hit on that, and instead like release people and deal with my own side of the street, which believe me is messy enough most days.
A couple of contacts from listeners here. Carter Wolf Creek dropped off. He wants to thank you for the metaphor of the mind as a pinball machine. He really likes it. And here is a call from Anne in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Anne Lamott.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep. Awesome. Okay, so I'm nervous, and I'm not really good at asking really relevant questions to people on the radio. But
it's first time for everything.
I want to just say that I want to thank you for all your books, for your work. I admire you greatly, and there has not been one thing I've read of yours where I didn't end up crying good tears.
And thank you.
Yeah, it's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you so much.
I notice, Anne, how generous you are with your time. I mean, I was mentioning on the last blackout we had that looking at other interviews, it seems like you've had quite a string of radio stations talk to you before this one.
I have. I've been on a book tour for 5 weeks, and it's all been on radio stations. It's all been podcasts. It's all been some live, which I love the most, and an NPR, which I love the most, and supporting independent bookstores, which I love the most. I always tell people if they shop at independent bookstores, they'll get a better seat in heaven near the dessert table where I hope to be. But also, it's NPR and independent book stations, but I got to say I use Amazon like daily because I really will need a book by tomorrow. But luckily, I believe that Earth is forgiveness school, so, you know. And I think we all get to heaven. So,
Anne and Ashlyn, thank you for overcoming your fears and talking to Anne Lamott. Very much appreciate that.
I love that. Yeah.
And how much do you read, then? I mean, you're talking about having to have a book today. I mean, what tomorrow?
Well, you know, for me, because I am unemployable. You know, I'm a writer. I don't have a job per se, and I don't write before and after publication. I'm just too stressed and cuckoo and. So I've been reading a lot for the last 13 months, so I really need an endless supply of books. Sometimes I get on ebook or whatever you call.
On a Kindle or something?
Yeah, it's not. Oh, God, don't let my son hear that. He is so mortified.
He's going, Mom, I told you.
I mean, all parents are a mortification, but he just rolls his eyes and goes, oh, my God, you didn't say that on live radio, did you? You know, but anyway, whatever it is that on my iPad gives me e-books is what I use. And then I need books around me constantly. The New Yorker is delivered, and that is thank you, Jesus thing for me, but I will hear about a book and I need to read it. I read a lot of nonfiction during the day. I read the New Yorker, I read the Times and the Post, and then at night I need a big juicy thriller by about 10 at night so that I can read myself to sleep by midnight. There's a really funny piece, not to toot my own horn, but a funny piece in Dusk Night Dawn about buying my first big print book, a thriller at my favorite. And oh, by the way, you can get, this is just a plug, but people can get signed copies of Dusk Night Dawn at my local bookstore, which is Book Passage. Bookpassage.com will ship it to you anywhere if you want it signed for any reason. But anyway, I went there and I used their Wi-Fi during another PG&E blackout to download a book, and then I felt so guilty that I went and bought my first big print thriller. My eyes are terrible anyway. And then I realized it was like buying literary Depends. but now I'm hooked on big print. I love it. God, what a concept.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Let's take another call here. Kara in Eugene. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Anne Lamott.
I was going to say, bless and happy Easter, Anne.
You too. God bless you. Good.
And thank you for inspiring me again and Jefferson Public Radio, too, as I wash my dishes, which is what I usually do when I'm listening. And I have a question about how I need some help with confronting the pain of the judgment. I'm very sensitive to people that are judgmental. And as a community leader, there's, you know, the strident activist types on the right and the left, and they just, it's like you can't, sometimes you can't do anything because they want you to do the perfect, and you can't do anything because it's not the perfect. So it's like, a lot of us get paralyzed by that kind of judgmental attitude from other people. Do you have any advice on that?
All right. Thanks for the question, Kara.
That's a really good question. Thank you. Well, you know, for me, the hugest obstacle in my way as a writer, as an activist, as an everything, as a mother, as a Sunday school teacher, as a wife, is the perfectionism. And I wrote a whole book, a whole chapter on it in my writing book, Bird by Bird. And it is the enemy of the people. It is the voice of the oppressor. And what I have had to learn to do, and this is part of the grace of being in the third of my life, is that I had to learn to make a lot more messes and mistakes. I had to learn to fail better. And, you know, I had to learn to do things afraid. I usually waited until I felt very brave to do new things and try a new book or a new article or a new relationship or new anything. And now my battle cry is do it afraid, you know, and do it bad. There's, you know, the whole premise of Bird by Bird is doing things really badly, just doing a really terrible first draft. There's a great line of E.L. Doctorow's. I think it's in Dusk Night Dawn. I can't remember. I think I've maybe quoted it in every book. But it's the best line for a writer, but I think it's the best line for you, too, is that writing, or anything, is like driving at night with the headlights on. We can only see a little ways into the distance, but we can make the whole journey that way.
We have
and it's so un-American to do things where you don't know how they're going to turn out, or you're not going to be able to do them perfectly, but you just do it anyway. You can see a few feet in front of you, and you can make the whole journey that way.
Well, I was going to ask about that particular part of it, about the American nature of wanting things done now. Does that get in our way about not being able to see step by step? You just put one foot in front of the other and you walk your way out of a hellacious place.
Yeah. Left foot, right foot, left foot, breathe.
Comment here from Jason and Trail from email. He says, I think I understand your campaign for the positive, but it does no one any good to be Marin County Pollyanna. The Second Coming, the W.B. Yeats poem, ends with, and what rough beast, its time come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem. Do you not believe in the presence of real evil? It's not all about positive attitudes. Some energies must be fought.
Yeah, I do believe in evil. But I said in this book, you know, evil is not the drug cartels and the porn shops. It's our coldness towards others. It's not caring in me. I'm not talking about the evil in anybody else, but it's all around me. It's in my not caring, in the culture. I see it in the homophobia and the sexism and the ageism, and I just see it in the not caring, in turning away from suffering in me. And I just have to pray to not be such a whiny baby, you know, to not just, it's again the ism, the I self me. And, you know, let me just tell you, there's this, I've been sober almost 35 years, and in recovery I've heard this tool that helps me a lot. It's the three A's. The A is the awareness of it, that I'm shut down, I don't care, I'm very judgmental often. But as you get older, and I'm sure you sound much, much younger than I am, but even as you get a little older, you go into these places of maybe evil or maybe just coldness or dysfunction or judgment, but you get out of them a lot faster. In your 20s, they might last for weeks or a few days. Now at my age, I have them for a few hours. But so the awareness is the first day. I'm doing it again. I'm judging. My heart is cold. The second A is acceptance. Of course it is. I'm overwhelmed. I'm trying to be on Oregon and Northern California NPR, and I've been looking forward to this for a week, and I'm having a power outage. So of course I'm feeling a little tense and crunchy and cranky. I can accept it. You know, this has been an incredibly hard 13 months, let alone 4 or 5 years. And so I accept it. And then the action. What's the action? The action might be a radical self-love. I might say to myself, okay, Annie, would you like a lovely cup of tea? Would you like some of the leftover Easter eggs? Would you like, or you want to, as soon as we're done here, we'll just go for a walk. We'll take my old dog and my old self, and we'll go down to the park, and we'll look for wildflowers. And so, and what maybe the action is, I send off $25 to the food pantry in Marin City where my church is. Maybe it's at my church. I send it to my church. Maybe what I do is I go ask my son if he wants a cup of tea, because he seems to be having a bit of a mood today. But the action is almost always love, whether it's the radical self-love, whether I take care of the poor, which is about as Jesus-y as I know. And so those three A's help me over and over and over again. I do believe in evil. I don't believe in the fundamentalist right-wing Christian sense of evil. You know, my great friend Tom Weston said, you can tell you've created God in your own image when he hates all the same people you do. And that, to me, is what evil looks like, is thinking that God hates anyone. I mean, the secret, I think, is that God loves, period. So if you, so I don't see that Christian fundamentalist sense of evil, but I see it in my own heart, which is sometimes cold and stony.
Thanks for the compliment, but you only have 5 years on me.
You're kidding. No. Oh, my God. I'll be 67 next week.
I noticed that April 10th. Happy birthday
April
in advance.
10th. Thank you, sweetie.
Just about 45 seconds left. I mean, is part of our problem with forgiveness is we don't realize that we need to forgive ourselves for how awful we can be?
we were raised to not forgive. Our families didn't forgive. I mean, in my case, I'm sure your family was fine. But in our case, there were certain people that we just, that were unforgivable, like Barry Goldwater was unforgivable when I was coming up. They're racist. My parents were big civil rights people. My parents couldn't stand Christians. They felt themselves to be way, they were atheists. They were way superior to that. So I was raised to think other people were just too far gone. And I really had to make a comeback from that. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think we start with us, and maybe we just do one practice forgiveness person today. I have an aunt who has never approved of me. And you know what I'm going to do today? She's lonely and scared. And I'm going to call her. I'm going to say, "Hi, I was just thinking of you. I put my new book in the mail, but I just want to check in with you. How are you doing today?" You know, and that's pretty wild and radical. And that's enough for me to do today.
Dusk,
one step at a time.
One step at a time. Dusk, night, dawn on revival and courage. Anne Lamott, thank you so much. See you in 10 years.
I'll see you in 10 years, honey. Thank you.
Take care.